Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Venetia Valetti, the designer of Bloodbeam Badlands, Space Between Stars, and many, many more great games. He's an award-winning game designer who has contributed to works for Paizo, Evil Hat, and Haunted Table Games. And now, he is currently crowdfunding his latest game, A Land Once Magic. Venetia Valetti, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here.
We've been meaning to have you on the show for a long time now, but we keep just hanging out in person. And then we're like, oh, that counts.
And then, yeah, 100%.
So, Vidi, we're going to get into, we wanted to talk to you because you're a friend of the pod, friend of ours, and also because you're one of our favorite minds and designers in TTRPGs. And I think Brian said to me earlier today, you're like your favorite designer's favorite designer, the chaperone of TTRPGs.
Yeah.
And we're going to get into world building games and teaching and your upcoming adventures and having your games published, including by me.
Whoa.
But first, long before we were friends.
Which one, Elliot? Sorry.
Relax. Long before we were friends, I quoted you on this podcast multiple times as the person I knew of who says make bad games. So I want to talk about make bad games first. Can you take us through this philosophy of yours of game design?
So make bad games is a thing I love saying. It's a thing that I'm very happy to be known for saying. It's just like a fun way of saying, like, make a lot of things. Make games, even if they're going to be bad. The process of making something is a lot nicer and a lot more fulfilling than just sitting around and never finishing something. And, like, the adage kind of also has a secondary part where it's like, it's easy to make a game. It's hard to make a good game. So just make bad games, right? Because every time you make a bad game, the next game gets a little easier to make. And then eventually, you know, eventually after five bad games, your sixth game is good. And then the cycle kind of starts anew. And then, like, the game after that is maybe bad again. And then again and again, until you make another good game, and then maybe your last good game ends up being a bad game in the grand scheme of, like, your journey as a designer. I think a lot about game design through, like, my own background in, like, fine arts and visual arts and just art in general. I take games or art very seriously and almost literally, and particularly in the practice of being a game designer. And so make bad games is also kind of my way of, like, getting people to think about game design in the same practice of, like, make sketches, like, keep a sketchbook, make thumbnails, make studies, do little things. Like, if you want to get better at drawing hands, notoriously hard thing to draw, you have to draw 100 bad hands before you make a good one, right? Like, that's the whole process of just getting better at something. And so you should also think about games in the same way. Like, you're not going to come out the gate making the best game. Like, you're not going to come out the gate painting something really beautiful.
It's funny. I've never put that as well as you just did. I've never had that thought really click in my head of making bad games, like, making more of a thing. Is just like if you told someone you need to practice drawing by doing sketches, they'd be like, oh yeah, of course. But when you tell people, like, make bad games, you got to make a bunch of games before you make a good game, it feels like you got to do a bunch of the thing before you get to do the thing you really want, which of course is just what practice is. But yeah, it seems somehow more daunting when it's like, make a whole thing rather than just like, oh, sketch 100 hands.
Yeah.
Wow, that really clicked something in me.
Yeah. And like, in a bad game, doesn't have to be a 300-page hardbound, like, bad game, right? Like, a bad game can be a one page that kind of just maybe works and is more a funny read than a good play. That's a bad game, right? Like, you can write so many of those so quickly. You know, a zine is so great. I'm a huge proponent of making zines and zine culture because it's so much easier to just make a zine game, make a bad game, quotes, air quotes, and then move on to the next thing, right? And then also in that case, it's like, once you start getting good at drawing hands, you stop thinking about it. You have to stop, you kind of stop practicing drawing hands, right? And that's kind of the same thing for me with making a bunch of games is like, I really like making dice pool systems. A lot of my games, just my brain automatically is like, I want to make a dice pool. I want to make an opposed dice pool. To me, that's like my hands in a way where I'm like, okay, cool. I know I can do this. I no longer need to like play test whether or not this opposed dice pool system works or is fun or if the math is great. I just know it is. What I need to practice and what I need to like test and sketch and whatever are maybe like the greater structure around it or the thematic elements or the prose of the text itself. Like, you know.
So can you please list 5 bad games for us?
5 bad games, like my own or just in general?
No, this is just a fun gotcha question.
I'll do it. That's what I mean. It's like, listen, I could name 5 of my own bad games. Sure, fine. I will, if you ask me to, name 5 bad games by other people.
Maybe we'll do a Patreon cut. We'll bleep it out right now.
No, we're still talking. It's just like an elongated, like muffled.
Oh yeah, just 30 bleep. Seconds of
yeah. Yeah. So I mean, Viditya, this is the way you just put this whole thought about sketchbooks is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show. Is like you've been thinking about games in a very conscious, intentional way for a long time, in a way that, you know, we've been doing on the show now for about 1.5 years, almost 2 years, but you've been in TTRPGs for 5 years, if I'm correct? And change.
I guess, like, yes. I would say, like, my first introduction to the space, as in, like, I've published a thing, would be 2018 or 2019, actually. So a little bit more. I mean, like, I date my introduction to in TTRPGs industry, etc., officially, right? At the SAD Mech Jam, Emotional Mech Jam, which has a strict day, which is beginning of 2019.
For which you wrote Fire Flickers Between Us.
Between us? Jesus Christ.
I don't remember now.
Fire Flickers Between You.
Oh, thank God.
Because I remember I typed it wrong a bunch of times and I was like, I got to get this right.
Yeah. Jan 28, 2019, Eventual Night Jan. So that's where like I date myself is where I kind of entered the scene. It wasn't my first game that I published on itch and it wasn't. And I'd made role-playing games even prior to that, that I published and worked on and been thinking about more in like the Baltimore, local Baltimore scene of role-playing game and designers. And my college thesis was a role-playing game. And that whole process and me thinking about RPGs and designing them. And yeah, I mean, it was my college thesis. So like actively being a designer, that this was my one thing I had to do was basically all through 2018.
And you're also in a unique position for anyone we've brought on the show of being a designer who publishes games to put out there, but also teaches game design at a collegiate level.
I do. Yeah. I'm a pretty new professor of games here in New York City. It's very exciting. It's very strange, but it feels very right. I don't know. I'm like, ooh, I'm like a professor of games.
Get to buy way better jackets.
Yeah, lots of it's elbow true. Patches.
I'm trying really hard. So I teach at an art school. So like, it's like, I need to look good because these students are just so stylish.
So you've been in this industry for a while and only now are you really starting to, you haven't gone down the rabbit hole that almost every other designer we know has of just doing crowdfunder after crowdfunder after crowdfunder. Why has that never been a thing that you were super interested in doing?
Easy, simple question. I did one Kickstarter by myself and I fucking hated it. I was like, no. To the point that like it took, I think, almost 2 years to actually finish fulfillment for like a variety of different reasons. One being a big was quarantine and pandemic and stuff. And then, which pushed a lot of people's That was ZineQuest 2019, which happened in March or February of 2019 or 2020. Sorry, that's what it was. Yeah. So that was tough. And then just so much of it. I mean, I just learned a lot, and like my goal was really small, and it was a bunch of us kind of newer designers going like, let's do ZineQuest. Like, let's hit crowdfunders. We were all trying it out. This was still when like ZineQuest had 100, maybe 100 was even a lot. Like, this may be like 80 of us total. This was year two of it. So still pretty new, still pretty small. And I just learned that like, I can't be the one to do that. It was a really good moment that I had early in my career of being like, I am not a producer. I am not a project manager. I am a game designer. And I talked to a bunch of people, and like a lot of my friends from back then, like who I've known since then, like Tyler Crumrine, Possible World Games, Will Yopst, Good Luck Press, and Adam Vass, World Champ Gameco, like people I've known since then. I mean, like Jay Dragon, Blossom Creek, right? Like, it's like all these people who are like now have these companies and publish and do this. Like, they've like, I don't want to say surpass is like a bad word in the hierarchies, but it's like they've taken that turn, and I've had conversations with them, and I've talked to them about like, what is the difference? And truly it's, they're like, well, I can do it. Like, I can do the project manager if I need to, or I can do this and I can do that. Or they're like, our games make enough that I can pay for this and I can pay for that. Like, they've just built an audience, or they have whatever, or they have extra funds. They have a second job that they've been able to wean off of. And so all these various factors really just like, I think it's good. Like, it taught me what I'm good at, what I bring to the table, what I do well, and what I can't. It, like, I love knowing my limitations and working around that.
And I think that's a tough lesson that I think anyone who's tried any kind of creative endeavor comes up against the limitations. And it's very easy to not learn the lesson of like, what you are good at and what you aren't good at, and try to just like push through in a way that can either become frustrating or demoralizing, or just like lead you down bad roads of spending too much time on things you aren't good at. It's great that you were like, hey, actually, this part, not, no, thank you. I'm gonna do this part.
Yeah. Instead, I kind of hard pivoted into freelance was what I had to do. And also, I mean, the greater thing that I also say to people is like, I hard pivoted to freelance. I kind of did game design full time, but then I was like, you know, during that time I was at home, so I didn't need to pay for rent. So it's like financially, I also like made decisions and were in places where I could continue to just live off of that, or so on and so forth. So it was like, you know, instead of being able to do this, like, it was always kind of decisions to my strengths and tough ones too, right? I teach students, and specifically I teach undergrad seniors. So I've been having this conversation a lot of like, I have to wear so many hats, or what if I never get a job, or like, et cetera. And I'm like, these are valid things, and here's the truth behind them, right?
And I guess once you realize like, okay, this type of stuff, not for me, I want to focus on writing and like making stuff. How do you then, I think we've talked to a bunch of people on this podcast about how you make the pivot to doing it all. The answer is you just do it all. When you just want to do one thing, how did you then make that pivot into freelance?
I kind of was already, I mean, this is a big thing for me, like as professional advice, the like, how did I get to where I am kind of thing is entirely networking. And I say networking with like the capital N, kind of business networking, and then also the soft Comic Sans networking that is just kind of like, just like having friends, you know, like knowing people, like just being like genuine friends with people who are doing it also. So it's like a lot of my first freelancing gigs was just writing stretch goals for friends. So I was like, I'm not doing Kickstarters, but you should like, but, and they were like, yeah, don't do that. Do you want to write for mine instead? And I was like, yeah. So like enough of these things that just got me that hook and that start. And then like, once I felt comfortable, or once conventions kind of came back for pandemic reasons, then like, that's when like capital and networking started happening, where I'd go to places and I would talk to people. But because I had some, anything really, just any credibility underneath me, it became easier and easier to like find things, and also like utilizing, I went to like various POC events and stuff like that. So like, I don't know, bad timing on a lot of stuff before. Or like, sorry, it's like Dungeons and Dragons had a hard time with a bunch of things. And so a lot of companies were like, maybe we should be hiring people who aren't just white guys. And so it's a little bit of timing there too, but it's like, I was like, yeah, like I like to just write and I can do that. And here's all the things. And that's like kind of the path that led to, well, freelancing works kind of sometimes. Yeah.
Freelancing works kind of sometimes. It should be it works kind of sometimes should be like the slogan of freelancing everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, I would also say I kind of hate freelancing in all things, to be honest. Like, I mean, or I hated being a full-time freelancer. Like that was really stressful because I think I even lied to myself. I was going to say, I can only focus on three things. And I'm like, I really think I can actually only focus on two things. And that being freelance and like my own games. And then if I have a job, like, and then that job, and like, I'm juggling these three things that I can't juggle that much personally. So like freelance all the time, I kind of couldn't make my own stuff too much. And I found myself stressing about things. I'm really bad at writing essays, like all through my life academically. I would rather take a test than write an essay, like at home. If people were like, this class is an easy class, you only need to write two at home homework essays, that's the only thing. I'm like, I'm failing that class because I ain't writing those two essays. Well, somebody else is like, oh, this class sucks because it's like you have to write, it's like a test a week. I'm like, I'm passing that class because I can cram for a test, ace it, and then leave and never had to think about it ever again. And so freelance just kind of ended up being like, oh no, my livelihood is just writing essays.
And a job is a test every week. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
A job is a test every week.
Yeah, that's true. That's good. So Vid, I want to pivot into world building games, because this is an area that I know is like near and dear to your heart and connects to, you know, the game that we're crowdfunding right now, Land Once Magic. But starting broadly on world building game, I can't imagine someone's listening and hasn't heard of like what a world building game is. But if you're selling someone on a world building game broadly, like who hasn't played one before, how do you sort of explain what the experience is going to be?
How do I explain that? Woof. I know I have. I must have done this before.
I'm sure you have. You've done it with students, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay, so like a world-building game. Hey, Elliot, Brian. I know you've never heard of world-building games before, so let me teach you.
What's a world-building game?
Well, you see, it's like in its name, right? It's a game collaboratively... World-building, yeah. Oh, weird, important question. Is world building one word or two words when you write it?
I always write it as one word, but okay. Then it keeps autocorrecting to two words.
That's why I just want to double check. I feel like it's a game design thing. Like our genre, it's one word, but every once in a while, I'm just like, am I doing this wrong? So a world building game, I mean, it's like collaboratively creating, not like you're not playing characters, you're not embodying individuals, but it's like building out things at like a bigger scope. So a world building game, I guess it depends on like, you know, maybe what specifically we're talking about. I'm sorry to say Street Magic, one of my favorite games, is together, like we're going to build a city together. And in that city are neighborhoods and landmarks, and then the people that live, who visit and live near these landmarks. So there's like that scope of, hey, and then, you know, I could be like, hey, do you like Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities? And they'd be like, sure. Or what? And then I go, all right, cool. Well, let's build a city together. Or Beak, Feather, and Bone is also very like, all right, well, you know, here's a city map. And we're going to figure out like who owns what buildings and what goes on there. And kind of what's like, what are the conflicts that create from being in a shared space with each other, and so on and so forth. So it's like, to me, I love world building games just, and like Microscope also, it's like, it's the timeline of a world, but world cannot, doesn't just need to be a planet. Like it's a timeline building game. So it's like, what's the broad strokes of the story and the culture and the people and the stuff that we want to do? Actually, if I really had to think about it, what I love about world building games is it basically demystifies the encyclopedia. What do you call it when it's like there's just like this big dense lore block? Like there's like a term for it, right? You know what I'm talking about? Like, it's like, oh, this is like the Game of Thrones, like,
canon?
History. Canon. Yeah. Like the codex of this world. It's like, you know, you don't need to write your world Bible. Instead, you play a thing. Yeah.
I have found every time I've played a world building game, it's nice that in a normal role playing game, you're kind of telling like one story, but in a world building game, there's a lot of like implied stories.
Yeah.
That you never really see, but it's like, this guy lives next to this guy and they hate each other. You learn like one little thing about it, but then your brain kind of just like fills in that part of the world. It's hazy. Like, it's not as fine detailed, but it's still there. And all of a sudden you're making this much bigger tapestry rather than like a super fine drawing.
Yeah. I actually have really been thinking about this recently. And I don't know why.
Because we're crowdfunding a world building game that you wrote.
Why am I thinking about world building games?
Whatever could it be?
But like the joy of imagined play. Oh, you know what it is? It's because Grant Howitt posted a post on Blue Sky that was like, what do you hate writing? And then a lot of people, and then Grant was like, I hate writing examples of play. And a lot of other designers were like, I also hate writing examples of play. And I'm like, I love writing examples of play, actually. And I don't know why. And I think it's because I like imagined play a lot more, potentially a lot more than actual play in like a weird way. And it's like, and I think it's because world, you've nailed it, Ryan, right? It's like world building games are chock full of imagined fiction, of like imagined play. It's like you put these two things together and the table doesn't need to like go into it, but you're like, there's a story there. And like, that's the point of a world building game, is to go, there's a story there, but you don't hyperfixate. And that's kind of also why I mentioned the, like, this isn't like you're so, like, you don't need to write a Silmarillion to be a good world builder. You just kind of need
write the Hobbit.
You just write the Hobbit. You just put a few things on a map and you go like, and these are the few little points. And then suddenly you're like picturing the lives of these people without ever actually knowing anything about them or going into detail.
I'm honestly looking, I literally just glanced over at my bookshelf that's right next to me. And I feel like that is the metaphor I'm kind of going towards, of like, if you look at my bookshelf in general, you kind of get a general vibe of what all the stories in there are. And also by the titles, you have like this little idea of what each of those stories is. But until you pick up one of those books and read it, you don't actually know what that story is. Does that make sense? That's almost an idea.
Yeah.
There's a tapestry on the bookshelf that you have some sense of just by reading the little bits that you can see.
I mean, I think like that's the joy of, like, that's the joy of a lot of these things, right? It's like, why is it exciting? Why do we, as like game designers and players and things, like, why do we like having a table that's like, what's in your pocket, right? It's like, here, roll me like 3d6, and in your pocket is loose change, a photograph, and like an old trading card. We each, I think, like in this moment, know this person. We each have like a very, at least an idea of who this person is, right? What's the photograph? What's the trading card? How much change? Kind of thing, right? And that's like what a bookshelf is. That's what just like a city is, right?
It's interesting. It feels like world building games all have like the choice when you make a world building game is like, what angle am I coming at this world from, and what angles am I ignoring and letting be implied? How do you kind of think about that decision when you make, because you've made multiple world building games, I would say it's kind of a through line of a lot of your work. How do you kind of think about that decision and what makes that decision interesting for you?
I think the real answer is kind of, what world am I into right now? So like, what media am I watching? And then like, why am I interested in this world? Is maybe kind of what it is. Cause I don't even know. I think like, it's a good question. Cause to me, it's like, yeah, most of my world building games take a much broader stance, I think, at that concept. I'm like, A Land Once Magic is actually very broad in terms of like how much it asks you to make a world in comparison to other more specific games. But then I have a game like We Who Seek Titans, which came out at the same time as A Land Once Magic, that is like, it's a road trip game. It's like a game of people who travel and like, what is a world through the eyes of like being on a road trip, right? Like that's kind of what it is, right? It's like, I wrote that game after moving my brother from Kansas City to LA. So we did a cross country road trip, but like we started in New Jersey because he picked up a car and then we went all the way back over, right? And so we did a cross country road trip and that game kind of spawned from that because I was like, we're stopping in these small towns and I only get maybe a day because we are staying there for a hotel, or we only get 30 minutes because we're there for a meal or something, right? And then like, you know, we're also like throughout this country, we're like, what are these landmarks that are like being, that what are like the signs that are saying like, come here, like this landmark is here. And then I'm like, you only get like that snippet also as I'm like driving by. I'm like, oh, hey, world's biggest something. We actually did like, we stopped at every world's biggest thing that we could find because we just thought that was really interesting and fun. And the towns that were around that was so wonderful and beautiful. And I only got 2 hours in them. And so, yeah, that's kind of like, that's where that game came from. And so it's like the fascination. Okay, if I had to like give an answer, where is the specificity that I like to look for is, I think, kind of like, where's the love is maybe a good way to put it. There's so much that can define a place, but then like, what's the thing that is, what's like the love there, right? It's like, oh, these are landmarks. So We Who Seek Titans is about landmarks. A Land Once Magic is about, like, truly it's like about magic systems. That's the love of a lot of these worlds, right? Like fantasy worlds are like, oh, we have so much like cool magic, and like magic is so foundational to how the rest of that world works. So I'm like, that's the love of that magic, of that world. So I wanted to make a game about that.
If you choose what's important in the world you're looking at and just focus on that thing, then that you can have that one thing come into focus and everything else can kind of be inspired by or fade in the background based on that one thing.
Yeah. It's like, I really love cities. Like I'm a huge fan of cities. And I think like, that's the beauty of a city. I mean, we're all in New York. It's the greatest city on earth. And the thing is like, you look at New York and like, you can focus. I can make 1,000 world building games that make a New York, right? That each focus on a different thing. And like, that's the beauty of, I think, that's also like the beauty of a world building game is exactly that. It's like, you can feel something is lived in, even though you're not being exhaustive about it.
Yeah. If you did a, man, that just, I want to do a world building game now just about encounters on the subway.
100%.
The whole subway thing.
Yes. Right?
Like, I love 100%. The subway so much.
I love the subway so much too.
A public transit world building game in general would just be really great.
I've had an idea for a world building game that is just the whole structure of it is, and somebody can steal this and make this before me. Please do. I mean, I'd love to. You two can do it. It's just you just build the world through transit stops. And the way it works is that you just start with like a subway station. And then what you do is you then connect it to another station. And then my thought is you follow a person to their transfer or to their destination.
Till
they get off. So it's like you build like a person. So like, why are they traveling? Where are they traveling to? Why is this place a stop? Like, why is this an important stop in a station? What's around it? And then you just move on, right? And then so you're just kind of building a transit map. And yeah, it's like, because that's world building. That's so fun and cool.
There's also some great stuff about like New York of like, where do train lines intersect? What stop is express versus what stop isn't, you know? And then you have like old IRT and BRT lines, like how there used to be multiple subways and now it's all under one system and how those changed. They had different, you know, all this stuff.
That's love, right? Like that's like the...
We love the subway.
We love the subway. And that's why, like, that's it. Like, what's... Like, I wouldn't want to play a world building game that ultimately I wouldn't want to see myself living in. And that doesn't mean like every game, like I can play apocalyptic games, I can make shitty worlds. But the idea is like at the end of it, I'm like, like, I feel like I can exist here in some form or another, right? That's the point.
Right. You in that space and time could fall in love with the world. It's the talk of the
table. Midnight Muscadines is a cozy dark tabletop role-playing game where light and shadow intertwine in a fractured world. Players take on the roles of Marmiteers, brave adventurers who journey into the untamed Wildernight to collect the elusive Midnight Muscadines, craft magical jams, and protect the fragile light of Nim. Through collaborative storytelling and resourceful gameplay, players weave tales of courage, community, and the pursuit of balance. Will you preserve the light, uncover the truths hidden in the shadows, or reshape the balance of the world forever? Midnight Muscadines is perfect for fans of Studio Ghibli and Sea of Stars who seek to capture the magic of exploration and the heartfelt adventure in a world where small heroes make a big impact. Play Midnight Muscadines as a traditional GM'd game, GM-less, or even solo. Midnight Muscadines is crowdfunding now on BackerKit. Join the campaign at pandeongames.com/muscadines.
I'm Quinns of tabletop role-playing game review show Quinns Quest, and this is Play to Find Out. Play to Find Out is an actual play podcast that brings notorious old games from the 80s and 90s back to the table. Each season of Play to Find Out, I'm joined by Emily Johnson and Rob Morgan.
Good? Nervous?
Yeah.
You both looked at each other really concerned, like you think what's about to happen is going to be unpleasant. And frankly, I think that's rude.
And together, we explore the TTRPGs of ages gone by. Our goal? To separate the TTRPGs that deserve to be remembered from those that maybe don't.
I
don't know, Emily. It was the 80s. A lot of people were on cocaine. We blow the dust from decrepit systems to learn how they work.
Your 100 on the encounter table bursts out. Right, you've encountered a bug. Get ready. Don't laugh.
How does one get ready for a fog?
Don't laugh.
Encounter their unique quirks.
I do finger guns to cover up how I wince.
A weird thing happens as you do finger guns.
Oh, no.
And I'm hoping that the Quinns Quest community will join us in exploring these games too.
If you this up, cannot describe to you how much your adventure ends here.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because the best way to learn is to play to find out. Play to Find Out is available now on the Quinns Quest Patreon, but the first episode of each series streams for free on the Quinns Quest YouTube channel and wherever you get your podcasts.
Anyway, you failed the Earth Tech roll, and you made jokes while I was doing my exposition, so you don't get to hear any more.
No. Come on.
I was shooketh.
So you've mentioned it, we've talked around it. I think let's talk A Land Once Magic.
Yeah.
What is A Land Once Magic for those uninitiated? And, well, actually, I'm going to save the second half of this question. Let's start with what is A Land Once Magic?
Okay. A Land Once Magic is what I'm calling a post-fantasy world-building game, which is a conversation that Elliot and I had a few times about, hey, should it be a post-fantasy world-building game as like a marketing tool? Because that's a made-up term that I kind of came up with. But it's just a like conversational world-building game is how I would put it. You just use a deck of cards and a variety of different prompt tables where often you would just draw a card and it either like finishes a sentence, so you don't even need to do much other than add detail, or asks you a question and then you answer them. The whole point is that it's very seamless is the idea. It's not very gamey. You just have a conversation with friends by answering questions and then riffing off of each other. I've had it described like very complimentary as a writer's room game. Like you eventually just start spitballing ideas and tossing stuff around. It gets the ball rolling. And then also A Landless Magic is, I mean, if we want to get like into it, like, I mean, it's also kind of like a Session Zero-y game. Like I explicitly made it as something that's like kind of that thing is like at the end of it, I want you to feel like, oh, I like can immediately picture what person I would play in a game or what game I would make about this or like what story would I want to hone in on and talk about and stuff.
And
wait. I want to know, where did each of you fall on is post fantasy good or bad?
Well, I'll tell you. I'll tell you what happened. I'll tell you what happened.
It was a fun conversation. Yeah.
I agreed to publish. Or I wanted to publish. We talked about whether we were going to do it. I finally was like, yeah, let's go. I want to do this with you. Like, and Vidi was like, yeah, you seem like the right partner for it. Like, let's do it. And about 2 weeks into that creative partnership, I was like, I sent, I think, a Discord message. I was like, okay, so post-fantasy, what is that? and should we stop using it in marketing materials? Because I don't want everyone to say, what is that?
Yeah.
But I was convinced because we had a conversation about like what your goals are for this term post-fantasy. And I think it actually is a very interesting, unique thing that makes this not a fantasy, just fantasy world building game.
Yeah.
So why don't you give Brian the argument you gave me that convinced me?
Yeah, convince me.
Okay, so post-fantasy, which also through conversations with Elliot, I've been like, oh, it's more of it's like an ideology is kind of more how I think about it. But like post-fantasy and in what I wanted to do with A Landless Magic was I'm like, fantasy is cool. And also I'm thinking like 5 years ago, fantasy was going through some rough stuff, at least in role-playing games. Like we're talking a lot of problems with colonialism and xenophobia and various like racial foundations. Like fantasy as a genre, historically tough, right? Like there's kind of I think so, right? Like it's kind of tough. At least like Western fantasy is how when I think fantasy, I think Western fantasy. So like A Landless Magic was me, it was the thesis of it is like I want to make a fantasy world builder that gets you to make something that is very much that kind of like, what do we love about Western fantasy? Like, what do we, when we picture fantasy, what is it that we think about? But then instead of just being a game that like skirts around or not even skirts around like in a cowardice kind of way, but like there's a lot of other games that overtly are like, we're decolonizing, we're taking this out, like we're moving away from X, Y, and Z. Or this is a game that is about making fantasy that's closer to, you know, like Indian fantasy or other cultural things. I mostly wanted to be like, I want to make a game that's like gets you to interrogate a little bit these problems and move past them, like to take the proper step forward or to be like, hey, if you're going to have a variety of fun fantasy races, why? Kind of, you know, like what is like, wait, like, let's start from a new foundation of like, if you want to have elves, orcs, goblins, and all these guys, let's start from a new foundation. Let's not go back to your perceived idea of what they are, because I like your beliefs or not, they are steeped in problematic things and it's hard to move past them. So that's what like post-fantasy meaning, like an evolution on the Western fantasy that we know, a purposeful refoundation to concepts that we like in traditional fantasy.
So I like that as a concept. Can you give me a a like concrete example of what that looks like in the game? Because I think the idea, I'm like, yeah, of course, but I have no idea how you do that with a prompt. What does that look like in the game?
Okay, I guess like a thing that I'll start actually with like a legend. So like in the game, the first thing that you do is you come up with a legend. And the reason why I wanted to do that was because I like that fantasy's thing is myth. There's so much history in fantasy where it's like myth is a part of a fantasy world's ecosystem and history and stuff. And like it's a relation to that, right? Like, oh, what was once myth is now for real, you know? And so like to get players thinking is like you come up with like a legend and what their story tells, and then purposefully it gets warped. like that's the third thing that ADs do. Like a legend is told of a band of rebels. Their tales tell of unifying liberation. But now the legend has been warped, giving rise to faith, right? And so like I think that just like in starts to get players to think about like, okay, well, history gets changed and like people can like facts aren't set in stone. Like there's something about that that to me is get like intrinsically gets players to be like, it's kind of, I tried to be in the same conversation as like some people, like some cultures in your world can be like orcs are evil, but then you go like, yeah, but that's because something got shifted. Like your opinions were warped and changed. Like facts got messed up and core ideologies and themes can kind of be shifted around. So,
right. You like take the legend of like Sauron and the rings and then it's like, but actually what's the warped?
What's the warped element of it?
Actually, yeah. He was kind of okay.
Actually, he was kind of a chill guy who just like making jewelry.
Got a real bad rep. What's up? He gave all of his buddies rings? Are you kidding me?
Where's the Wicked of Sauron, right?
Like, where's the Wicked of Sauron?
Oh my God.
Honestly?
Wait, straight up.
Straight up, I would watch the Wicked of Sauron. Maybe that's kind of what they're trying to do with Rings of Power, but I fell off. So
I didn't even bother. I truly was like, I can't watch this. This looks like a soap opera.
So Brian, post-fantasy, you feeling like your soul, you're getting there?
I got another thing also that the game does, if you want to know.
Yeah, keep selling
I mean,
me.
Like, so the thing is also it like the second thing that you do in the game is you give touchstones. And I explicitly say, pick one piece of media not traditionally considered fantasy, which feels almost like it's cheating. But I am just like, hey, like we're making a fantasy world. But instead of you thinking about Lord of the Rings, instead of you thinking about Game of Thrones, instead of you thinking about X-Y-Z, I want you in your brain to be thinking about like
Law and Order SVU.
100%. You know what I mean? Like, yes. And that's going to radically kind of change the foundations of the fantasy world you're making, right? I'm like, ooh, I'm going to think about...
You've got that great example from Con, that you or MAGFest.
Oh, yeah, which was House MD. Right?
Oh, hell yeah.
And Legally Blonde.
And Legally Blonde, which is Amelia Sum, Ames from Shout Out Unprepared Casters, did Legally Blonde. And Law & Order SVU, actually, you said it's a very similar thing where you're like, all right, what the fuck is that going to do to our world? Like, now we're thinking, and then I also go, like, what particularly from that do you want to bring in? So, like, Brian, like, what about Law & Order SVU?
I know nothing about Law & Order SVU. It's just the show okay. That I know has the most episodes.
Well, Brian, so, what about, like, Columbo? You're a big Columbo.
Oh, Columbo. Let's talk about Columbo.
Yeah, what's an aspect of Columbo that you want to bring in as, like, a touchstone? Like, what is the thing that you're jazzed about Columbo about, you know?
Oh, this is a whole other podcast. Okay, actually, the thing I like about Columbo is that it immediately breaks the mold of what a lot of detective shows do. It's not a whodunit, it's a how catch 'em. So like in the first 15 minutes, you always see who the murderer is and how they did it. And it's about Columbo trying to figure out how they did it and find the proof and then get them. And also every episode always ends with like Columbo saying, here's how you did it. And the murderer is always like, well, you got me, good sport. You're really good at this job. I'll go willingly. And it's the balm that the world needs right now. Just like criminals who are trying their best and then get caught by a good cop who then is just like, they're just like, yeah, we're on different sides, but you beat me this time.
It's like, what if crime was like a sport and like, you're like, ah, you got me. Like, good game.
It really has the vibe of, yeah, of the teams high-fiving at the end of the game.
Crime has rules like anything else.
I mean, that alone is this fun element that we can like think about, right? Like if we were playing a game of Land of Magic, you could say like, I want to think about Columbo's How Catch'em. And this idea, or even more interestingly, this idea that people kind of play by the rules, right? And then I'm like, all right, cool. And then like Elliot would say something and then I would say something. And then like, that's kind of our new foundation. So when I ask you a question like what recent invention are people adapting to? I know that feels like it's going to be really out of left field or what are its drawbacks? But more often than not, people will be like, oh, you know what? Like maybe it's a like a thing of like a zone of truth or like a lie detector is like the new invention, right? And it's like nobody's thinking about lie detectors really in fantasy worlds as like a core concept of like what we need to be worrying about when it comes to like building a new fantasy world from the ground up. But I think like,
right. Or we just did magic DNA testing.
Exactly. Like that's the new thing. That's new technology. And people are like, oh, hold on. Crimes just got a lot harder to commit.
It's also the power of, ooh, just one more thing.
Just one more thing.
It's a big cloud thing. He always says just one more thing.
So getting us back on track a little bit.
Sorry.
Yeah, I led us astray. I got too excited about Columbo.
No, I brought up Columbo. It was my bad. I knew what I was doing.
You unleashed this.
I did. Vidi, A Land Once Magic, people might not know, 5-year-old game.
Yeah.
How has this game developed in 5 years, and why is now the time to bring it to print?
Oh, it's developed in a lot of ways. I was thinking about this today, about like the lineage of my games, I guess, is kind of one thing. I guess we'll kind of this two questions will go in order. So remind me to answer the second one. It's like it's developed through the years because this was initially a game that I made more or less just to play at like conventions and at friends' places. Very particularly, most of this game was play tested while waiting in lobbies of Titanfall 2. So like me and my friends would just play Titanfall 2, and then I would draw a card, ask them a question, they would answer, and then we would do that until a match started. So like it was already very conversational, and then I just kind of kept building off of it. More specifically, I guess it's like my game Space Between Stars has a world building section right at the front. You build your world and then you play in it, and that's a space game, that's a sci-fi game. And I was like, well, I like how those tables work, so what if I just try it for fantasy? And then so it's just kind of in this game that for a few years I'd like bring back out. It's really easy to play. I like just messing around with it. And then I do have my own habit of like I release a game, but actually I'll say like a lot of people do, especially mostly digital designers, is like you release a game digitally. It's good for a while. It's kind of in the zeitgeist. And then even you yourself move on to other stuff. And then it kind of falls to your lower half of your itch page. And then so like there was a moment maybe like 2 years ago where I started trying to figure out how to turn more of my games into zines because I liked having something in my hand. And A Land Once Magic was one of those games that I kept being like, oh, I'll come back to it. And when I initially released it, it was basically just a Google Doc and like pretty shitty like tables. Like it was very unlaid out. And I was very open about this. I'm like, hey, this is a cheap game, basically a work in progress, and I would slowly kind of work on it. And it was also a really nice game where I was like, I want to practice my layout. So I like used it to practice my layout because it's pretty repetitive text and it's just tables. And so like kind of going back to the make bad games thing, A Land Once Magic is almost a, there's a term for this, like some like a case study for it, right? Where like I made it. It's not a bad game, but it's like a poor, like, but like I released it in a state that nobody should have bought it, kind of, right?
You sketched in pencil for a long time.
I sketched in pencil for a long time, yeah. Like, it was like people were paying for my sketch, like for like sketch layers. And then like I would come back to it because I was like, oh, I like this game. I want to come back to it to try this skill, to try this practice, to add something to it. As I started thinking about fantasy world building, I was like, you know what? I had like this thread on Twitter that I really enjoyed where I was like, I'm done with fantasy maps. I kind of do not care about thinking about things spatially and geographically. And then so I added a table to A Land Once Magic that was like, I care a lot more about what a culture's calendar looks like. What is a world's calendar? Like, how does time move forward? So I added a table for A Land Once Magic for that. And then I added another table for like city stuff that I thought was interesting and so on and so forth. And then like just over the years, like other project ideas would give me an idea to go back to it. And then I was like, I want to try and print some zines because I'll shout out Aaron King. Aaron King has like a philosophy of like making games for libraries, or like your game should be able to be printed at a public library or at least like their games, like Arian's games is like, now I'm making all of my games to be easily printable at a public library. And I was like, I want to try that. So Land Once Magic became my testing ground for that, where I like made it into a thing that prints easy in booklet format. And that was like maybe like a year ago. And then I started really enjoying zine swapping with people, and I got into bookbinding. And so like Land Once Magic was a thing I would print and then just hand stitch really quickly, and then I would hand it to people. And then like, as it became something that I cared about more in a public sense, I was like, oh, I actually would love this in a real capacity, right? Like, I think I would really like to see this come to like a good, proper fruition. And again, like kind of going, bringing something back that we talked about before is like, through essentially like understanding my limitations of being like, I'm not a person to crowdfund this. I've actually hit my limitation of, to me, a Land Once Magic is a thing I print, I hand stitch, I could do that. I could do 20 copies of that if I really wanted to, because I just enjoy that process. It's a thing I love. And I could sell them for like $8 at local cons and so on, right? And hand to friends. But then like through the years, like I'm very lucky to have friends who are like, hey, like I'd publish something for you. And through like networking and just being a genuine person in the community, I'm like, oh, hey, I love A Land Once Magic. I know it's a good game, because similarly, it's something that I've spent practicing and developing and making in that same style of make bad games good. Like, games are easy to make, good games are hard to make. That I'm like, I don't think you need to take a gamble on this. At least like to me, I'm like, this is tried and true. It stood the test of time. Every time I come back to it, I still think it's great. And then, yeah, like that's kind of where it goes. And so I was lucky to have people, Elliot in this case, who like trust me that I make something good, that my name means something to them, and that I, you know, and like that it would be fun to work with. And so that's kind of like its fun little journey as like this case study of a lot of the things that I truly believe in as like a creator. And like as a game designer and an artist, it's not about the final product. Like the end product of A Land Once Magic is never a product, right? It is in itself like the journey of it being a creative thing. And then now it's entering a new phase and a new life. And like, hopefully, you know, it does well. And what does that look like? And now it's like, oh my God, it's like a little pocket-sized book and it's got all these little things. And I'm like, now it takes on a new form of creative joy. And
I'll say, it's going to be a good product, too.
It's going to be $1 million.
Yeah, at time of release, the campaign's already raised $1 million, I'm sure.
Man, we're the first world-building project to make $1 million. We've broken BackerKit. You're probably listening to this because you can't even back the game.
Brandon Sanderson, eat your heart out.
So Vid, kind of last thought on A Land Once Magic is, I think that people would be forgiven for having the thought of like, how do you end a world building game? We could just keep building. But A Land Once Magic has a particularly interesting end that I want you to kind of tell us about. And then where do you hope people go from there once they've finished playing a game of A Land Once Magic?
Yeah. I'm really happy with how Land Once Magic ends. It's like, through playing it, like at conventions and stuff, I found a good way to put it that's not in the game text, but you end with a table called A Journey in the Land. And it's a zoom in of, cool, it's like, I mean, I could pull it up right now, where it's three kind of prompts. You zoom into the world and it's like, when traveling with a troop of like entertainers during an unexpected crisis, a story is being told of omens. And so like what I like about that is like it puts you kind of like right down into the world itself. And I always like to picture it as like you're around a campfire. Somebody is telling a story about something. And then that to me is like, instead of a a lot of world building games that kind of have epilogues. It's like, cool, you've explored this world, or you often kind of see it to an end. I always like to think about A Journey in the Land is the prologue. It's like right up to, and now like the specific stories start, right? It's here's the moment that led up to the, I mean, I could say like the Wild Sea, your Wild Sea season kind of starts in like this action-y moment, right? My idea is like, and it's like in this transit area, ship is having to be dealt with some kind of a problem. And so like, that's kind of what A Land of Magic ends with, is like, cool, who's your character? What's going on? Who's listening to the story? Who's telling the story? What's the thing that's happening? It's like, oh, it's a holiday. Like you're traveling with an army during a holiday. And a story is being told about traditions. And it's like, okay, what does that mean? Like, and as you've spent this time, you go like, oh, it's probably this faction's army. And what's the holiday? Ooh, it's probably like this city, like we're about to travel to a city. So it's like, or it's maybe like the holiday that is the legend that we came up with. And they're telling a story about this. And then every time I've played it, I get to go, who's sitting around this campfire? Who's the person that you would be interested in playing, or the thing that you'd be interested in exploring? And then everyone always kind of has like a very different thing. And they've essentially made their character by the end of the game, right?
I really love that idea, because I've always heard people say that like learning a new language, you know when you've learned it when you can tell jokes in it. And this very much feels like you are, throughout the process of the world building game, building a language, like a shared communal language together. And then now it's like, okay, now it's time to create within those shared bounds that we've created.
I think that's a really fun way to put it. You're now ready to tell a joke. It's like, so like that is kind of the thing. It's like, now everybody go around and tell a joke, but it's like I'm 100% a soldier with this army who is, you know, like I manage the giant flying squirrels, and my weapon is like whatever, right? And it gets so like in the language of like, hey, remember that thing that you brought up? I'm now that thing. Or like, I really want to explore that. I am the poet that studies the ancient text that's written on the tree bark, and so on, right? Like, and you're like, oh, and everybody knows exactly what you're talking about because it's so specific to that world.
That's, yeah, to throw another metaphor, I guess, in here. It's like,
yeah, more metaphors.
You've been living in the world, and now you know, you realize who you've been living as. Like, as you've been playing, you've been living as the person, and it's like, oh.
And I think also that's the joy of world building games, right? We're talking about like world building games as like this, they can sound like these huge, big endeavors of like, oh, you're building worlds. But actually it's like these narrow focuses of like, well, what about a world do we actually love and care about and want to make? And that's like my favorite thing about them a lot is like, you can play a world building game to set yourself up for a campaign, or you can play a world building game during like a long running campaign because you just want to like focus in on something. You know, you can like, there's so many, like it's what do you want to focus on and how does it inspire you? Like, I think world building games are the most inspiring things. Like they, like a character driven thing tells a story, but like Brian, what you said, it's like a world building game like implies so much story.
It creates a million stories that you can explore whenever you'd like to.
You can explore whenever you'd like. It's like maybe like I want to play Microscope to know the history of our world before we play it. Or I want to play Microscope 10 sessions in because we know we've been playing this one snippet and I want to now canonize like, or kind of figure out like, what happened
right.
What before?
Mean?
What does that mean? And then also the joy of like, and then now you're playing in the future. So it's like, maybe like you can, as a table now, know that like, cool, our D&D campaign is going through like, I don't know, like this giant war between countries. Who knows what's going to happen? You play Microscope, you know that the war ends, or you keep it like vague. Maybe you don't know what happens in the next 100 years, but you do know eventually things happen in the future, and it's like,
yes, this war is called the 30 Years War. I wonder how long it will last.
How fucking long? It's really messed up that they called it World War One. You know, like that's really it's real pessimistic of them. How did they know?
But it's, as we come to a close here, there is a question that I think is important. Of we've mentioned that you've been designing games for, we've decided, but somewhere between 6 and 7 years, have a bunch of games on your belt, and it's been announced that, you know, Land Once Magic is going to be published with More Blueberries. Space Between Stars is going to be published by Possible World Games, Tyler Crumrine. Why now for those things? And why those games out of your large repertoire of games?
Why now is, honestly, I think it's like a personal reason is actually what it is. Like, there's no, ooh, I've checked the markets, or like, this is like the thing. It's more like thinking back on, I said, like, I actually kind of hate freelancing, or I hate freelancing full time, right? And this deep kind of like, I miss making my own games. And as the years move forward, like, as I am a part of this industry, this is like maybe a sobering statement to say out loud, but it's like, I'm like, oh, I love what I do and I love what I make and I keep making things, but I find myself like year after year not publishing a new thing because I'm like working on somebody else's things, even if I love them. That's not like a value judgment, but, and like, or I have like a job, like I now teach. So like that takes a lot of time, and, but it also helps me financially. Like I'm no longer struggling as much as I used to. And so it was like a choice for me that I was like, 2025, I want to focus on myself. And what that also means is I want to kind of put myself back out there as like a designer. I want to take my next step as a designer. I think like I hold so very deeply, like with so much appreciation, that incredible designers have called me their favorite designer, or have quoted me, or have said my games are like inspiration for their stuff, like amazing people. And I love that so much. And then now I'm like, yeah, but I also kind of want people to play my games. And I'm realizing that like the way to do that is they can't just exist as PDFs online. They need to be in physical form. And so like, I'm like, oh, I want to put some stuff out there. I want to kind of hold things. I want my games to be played. And I think like the joy of it also is like a lot of these friends were like, well, we're taking our next step too in publishing other people's stuff, because they've been spending the last few years publishing their own stuff and building out their own roster and all these things. And so like that's also just been really lovely, is like kind of worlds, or like, you know, things collided at the right time, overlapped at the right time, where I'm just like, oh, well, what about this one, or what about that one? And like these are games that I, Bloodbeam Badlands with World Champ, is like a match made in heaven for me, right? Like it's one of my favorite games that I've made. I think it's so full of love and or it's so full of style and bombastic nature, and it kind of sells itself. And it's miraculous that the current form that it's out is doing as well as it does. and like Space Between Stars is like, was my college thesis. So that's like coming up on 6 years, 7 years of since I've like worked on it. And it was such a slow burn. And it's like, I just want that game out there now. And this, like, I think it's one of the best games I've made, but like nobody plays it because I literally launched it before I knew anybody. Right. and then we went through the Land Once Magic kind of journey. And so it's like, these are just games that I have a lot of confidence in. And also, like, you know, as like a piece of advice and a reassurance to other designers, especially newer designers, this like idea that a game can always come back, right? You can always bring a game back. And I like really kind of held that to heart, where it's like, just because I put something out there in this form does not mean like it stays in that form, or I can't put something out there because it's not in the greatest form. It's not in its final perfect form. You can, you know, it's like, all right, cool, time to like bring these guys up. I think these are the ones that I want to see better. I want to see in a better state right now. And I'm sure maybe next year, We Who Seek Titans might be up there, or the fire flickers between you just might get like a slightly nicer thing that I can actually hand out to people and so on and so forth, right?
I love that the answer of sometimes the best answer to a question like this is because I fucking want to.
it's just
that sounds cool right now.
I want to, yeah. I'm like, it's like I'm going back to conventions and I'm like, you know, my friends are, y'all were boothing at PAX Unplugged and I was like, oh, like I'm so full of love and joy for my friends. And I'm like, man, I want my games to be on that table. You know, like that's kind of what
we want your games to be on that table.
Yeah,
I
we
know.
Do. And
I
they
want,
will be.
I want, Brian, I can't wait to hear how you pitch ON1's Magic to people.
Oh, I'll come up with something. Okay. I always come up with one little cute line that just gets them. It just, I love selling games at cons. It's one of my favorites.
You're fucking good at
You're
it.
You're so good at it. It's such a fun. And I also love doing it. Like, I'm there, right there with you, Brian. Like, selling games at cons is so much fun. Hey, what the, like, how do I get you to, like, love something in
it's
this
great
moment?
Because it's, like, the easiest audience in the world. It's people who already love this kind of stuff. And you're just like, hey, let me see if you're this exact kind of weird. And if so, boy, howdy, am I going to make your day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Money doesn't
matter. Money in their pocket.
Yeah. Money doesn't matter. It's just, what kind of weird are you? Oh, you're my kind of weird.
You're my kind of weird.
Yeah. So, Viditya Valetti, our final question that we ask everyone who comes on Talk of the Table is, what are you bringing to the table? And I know you listen to the show, so you already know what this is. It's a recommendation for our listeners. What would you like to recommend to the Talk of the Table audience today?
Oh, I've thought about this question a bunch. This is the one thing I was most nerve-wracked about. But I think I figured it out. We're talking about world-building games. We're talking about things that I love. So I got two videos for you. They're the things that I think really changed how I thought about world building, or it's like videos that I come back to and watch almost every year, every 2 years or something. It's two videos by Rhystic Studios on YouTube,
yeah,
which is, you know, he's like a big Magic the Gathering person. And it's The Colors of Ravnica and The Structures of Ravnica.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Ravnica's my favorite.
It's
my favorite setting. It's such a great setting.
So happy.
I think Ravnica is like a master's class in learning how to write a living, interesting world that you can just jump into and is full of interesting conflict and all these different things. But specifically those two videos, The Colors of Ravnica and The Structures of Ravnica, are talking about card art and how, like, the world building that goes into what is the palette of each of these guilds and what is the palette of Ravnica. And very specifically, I love thinking about the architecture of Ravnica. The Structures of Ravnica is such a good video because it's like each of these guilds are based off of different things and they're pulling from X, Y, and Z, and it's the philosophies of all these. And I love it so much. It's exactly that kind of thing that we've been talking about, is like world building can be anything. It's just the thing that you want to focus on. And it's like, I can make 1,000 games on New York City, and one of those games is going to be, we're just talking architecture in New York City. One of those games is, we're talking like the color palette through the seasons. Like, that's what that is.
Hell yeah.
You got to make the pizza world building game of New York City.
Oh, I got to make the pizza world building game.
Viditya Valetti, thank you so much for coming to the table. Do you want to let the people know where they can find you online and where they can find ON1's Magic?
Yeah, you can find me online basically everywhere at Viditya Valetti. That's my first name and last name. You can find my games at vidityavaletti.itch.io. I'm mostly on Blue Sky if you want to hit me up on some social media. And you can find ON1's Magic at alomrpg.world. That's alomrpg.world, where you can back it right now. It's live.
Yeah. It'll be live at release. Yeah.
And we're already at $1 million, Elliot.
Oh, my God. $1 million already. Go give us more.
No, you know what? If it hits a million, give your money somewhere else.
Yeah,
that's
truly
enough. That's
we truly have to. Yeah.
We're going to put all those links in the show notes below. And if you want more gamey content from us, please check out the Many-Sided newsletter, the Many-Sided Media Discord, and if you want to, support us on the Many-Sided Media Patreon, where you'll get bonus episodes of Talk of the Table, special roundtable episodes, and for our show My First Dungeon, over 50 hours of bonus actual plays, including The Fire Flickers Between You by our own Vidita Valetti.
That's me.
All those are going to be linked in the show notes below. Rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.